Chayfa gumatz ba yipal, pirate goda yishchena nachash. If a person digs a hole, there's a good chance that he'll fall into it. Pirate goda, if he knocks down a fence, which ought not to be knocked down, then yishchena nachash, the odds are that the snake, which is hiding inside the wall, will bite him. Masia avonim ye otzef bohem. Somebody fiddles around with heavy stones, he'll pull a muscle, some Dones pills. Vaikea etzem yisochem bohem. If he hacks wood, if he splits wood, tries to knock down the tree, yisochem bohem, puts him into sakana, tzasamu shanim lan. What the Sefer is telling us over here is that you don't have any action without a reaction. And don't take lightly changing matzavim. It's not necessarily good. Change, which looks great, needn't be great at all. That's a big mussar. I mean, you can have it in a small way, you can have it in a big way. In a small way, you know the Chazal, Moses says about the Chosid Echot, he saw somebody de-stoning his field, right? He had stones in his field, didn't want the stones in his field, so he took the stones and he threw them out into the Rosh HaSaravim. So he told them, why are you doing that? Why are you throwing these stones? Mereshus She'ena Shalcha, Mereshus Shalcha. Yeah, you're throwing it from your field, which doesn't belong to you, into the Rosh HaSaravim, which does belong to you. So he left. He said, it's the other way around. This belongs to me, and this doesn't belong to me. So Liyomim, he had to sell his field. He became poor, and he didn't have the field. And he was walking along the street, and he tripped on the stones which he had thrown out. So then he understood the words of the Chosid Echad, that the field which he owned was not his, because you never know, and the Rosh HaSaravim which he didn't own was his, because he's got a chelik in the Rosh HaSaravim. A lot of times a person acts selfishly to the detriment of the Ravim. He doesn't realize that the particular value which he's trying to attain within himself could be Rosh HaSaravim Shaloi. Hashem, that the tzayuch of the Ravim is preemptive. And if he would have put a little bit more koyach into the rabbin, to be misakin them, to make it good, to make it useful, to make it happy, then he would have a toilet from it. Put in a commercial. That's not, I mean, a lot of times, Bochum wants to do something which schwachs off the rabbin a little bit. He wants to go home early, he wants to go to the chasna, he wants to go this, he wants to go that. I mean, the emphasis is, a lot of times, if would cheshbon, that he himself would gain immeasurably if the yeshiva were the kind of yeshiva in which this doesn't happen. So why make it happen? You know, why sort of schwach off the sach? The meister, he stands to lose by it. I mean, there's a lot of wisdom to that chosid echad. But in a large scale, you can really sort of see a little bit like how true that is, that a person who sort of unthinkingly makes changes, like interferes with things without really, really knowing all the consequences, can really get hurt by it very much. Just coming back to last week from a chasna, I was talking to Rabbi Fein in the car, told him over, he was on the spoil from it, and stuck in the spoil to them. Hakon Moidim, everybody's Moidim nowadays, that America is in a pretty schwache matzav. Many things which are very, very terrible. You go on the street, get mugged, if you're not lucky, I mean, but at least it's, the matzav is so that it's, you know, a sensible person doesn't go out at night, except in matzavim, which is pretty well protected, but like this, there's a real and present danger. terrible crime in the inner cities. It's terrible. You have other enormous sociological changes. You have big changes, for example, the schools, inner city schools. So you have de facto segregation. You have the family. Families don't live together anymore. People move out to the suburbs. The old people remain behind. There's a lot of sorrow, a lot of lonesomeness, a lot of just very, very terrible things. And these things themselves bring their own results, their own nafkamin, as we made of the kids that brought up in the suburbs. They never seen old persons, so there's no sense of community, so there's no derech eretz. And we made of that structure of society gets messed up. So the kids don't have what to do, and so then they live artificial lives, and they go and start taking dope, like stutzer in the world, slapsach. There's been a really big disintegration of the social fabric of America. It really has. So what was the sibuk chayver for that? Why did that happen? Like if you're a sociologist and you're ma'ayan, and what was the sibuk? Like what created this terrible mess? Not that there are millions of sibuks, little sibuks. But if you can pinpoint sort of a zach. Where does the sibuk lie? So you ask yourself, you know, you've all had social studies, you know the history of America a little bit. Yeah. Who was, if you had to rank the recent presidents, last 10 presidents, so would you have a shitter? Who was a good president? Who was a bad president? And have you got any shitters about it? So you look like you know, you have idea. What's that? No. You're all the same. What's that? Alright, so there's a shitter which says that the nicest, most poshut of all the presidents was a Erlichem and didn't try to do anybody any harm, is at the bottom of all the troubles which America has today. That is Mr. Dwight D. Eisenhower. Why? Was it a schlechter Mr. Eisenhower? A feiner Mensch? Wer kann haben Feines? So that was all before most of you were born, probably. But Mr. Eisenhower was Mechadish, his biggest oifter, which at that time was seen as an unbelievable tikkun, a beautiful zach, like, which was very, very good, and malach raya ne'omen, everybody was very, very happy with the accomplishment and was machshavid enormously, was the federal highway system. Right? If today you can sort of roll along happily from New York to California without passing a traffic light, is Duffman Benson, Mr. Eisenhower. That was his schuss. He was the one who signed the legislation to set the federal highway system into effect. It's today the Yoidechein Zogen, as that federal highway system is the goyim for the whole disintegration of the social fabric of America. It's very partial. Yeah, it created the afsheiros of people moving away from the cities. In other words, it made the bedroom town. You know, people were still able to work in the city, but what did they have to live in the city for without a garden and without a swimming pool and without a this, without a that? So Heinz did a highway system, so they were able to move out to Westchester, to West, to New Jersey, wherever they were, they moved. And they created like a whole culture of the suburbs, and the whole tzur of society changed. Who could see Meroish that meant the disintegration of the cities, the elimination of the tax base, the entire chum of the educational system, the restructuring of families, the problems with the age? The Maizadikar Ha'or, you know, that here there was a Zach, which Lechayra, like, was very, very good. They can't have tainas, like, what's it like for the highway system? And the emphasis is, if you have to go from here to New York, it's a mechai. Yeah, you get on the road and like we're at New York, you and you can go to California without a traffic light. That's a Mishunati Kazakh. But it's not a Mishunati Kazakh, it's a very horrible thing. Chaznish has a shtickle. So I don't know, but here in the Emunah B'Tochen, like he's got this very interesting theory. He holds that many of the Yesoides of science, they knew in the time of the Gemara already. He brings a lot of Haichochas. For example, he brings Rayas that they made cesareans and the children lived. Yeah, which they weren't able to do till centuries later. So they came along with the consummation of the antiseptics, with the surgery, like it was a chiddush of the last couple of hundred years. The while you see in the Gemara, they had already living children with cesareans. Then he brings, for example, about the crown of David HaMelech, which the Gemara says, Milcom, the crown that he took from Milcom, Melech Ammon, was much too heavy. Couldn't sit on the human head. The Gemara says there was Evan Shoeves, there was a magnet up there, and the magnet suspended the crown exactly on his head. In other words, it sat on his head, but it didn't sit heavily because there was a magnet in the ceiling, and the magnet lifted. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a physicist. Lifted the crown, but I found that it didn't sit too heavily on his head, and a whole bunch of other things. Other tech he shows that. The Yesoides of Chochma, nature, science, were known. So we find it hard to accept because, I'm honest, did they have refrigerators or didn't they? And if Rav Huna had a refrigerator in his kitchen, so I mean, where did it get lost over the diaries? I mean, we know that in the 100 years ago they didn't have a refrigerator, so what happened? So he says that the reason is because they did not, in contrast to what's going on nowadays, they didn't see the rush of translating theoretical knowledge into practical application. In other words, it's not possible that a refrigerator is such a wonderful thing. It keeps things nice and cool, but it creates a culture of its own. In other words, once you have a refrigerator, you have to run a pasha with a freezer, and with a washing machine, and with a, what are those things called, the mix masters, right? And it's still such a ganze. That's a new Anaya Euler. So can anybody say that with all these labor-saving devices, for example, and with all these amenities, life is better today than it was centuries ago? You know, I'm sure if we had to choose, we're quite happy that we're living with refrigerators. But the emphasis in Sacha Koil, are we better off? I mean, it's a sort of a bland kind of question people ask it. But I mean, the emphasis, that's what the Chazon Ish is. Imam Steinberg, he says that who state that every theoretical knowledge has to be translated right away into a better mousetrap. They understood that not every shinui is a shinui for the better. I have no suffix that if, for example, it could be scientifically demonstrated that, in fact, Mr. Eisenhower's highway system is at the bottom of all our problems today. It's a theory. I don't know. It's a theory which has much to recommend it. I can't say that it's scientifically so. It makes a lot of sense. But let's say it could be proved. Yeah? And people would have had to vote. If we could turn back the clock of time and say, would we rather have had the highway system with the decay of the inner city, or would we, now that we've had the benefit of hindsight, have said, let's forget about 95 and be able to go for a walk at night with my kids in the street? I don't know. I mean, Libby Emily, we would probably prefer the perhaps less streamlined, but safer, more pleasant, more simple, more livable kind of life. So that's the Yesoid which the Chazon Ish says, as it does Shtei Taka in Der Chazon Ish. Don't go and make a change. half the time you could dig a trench and you could fall into it. You could never know. What's it negate to us? I mean, it's not, we're not about to build any highway systems or invent any mousetraps. So where is this negate to us? Negate to us, this is very much in the Indian of changes in chinuch, in the value system of the Torah. And a lot of times we would be well advised to remember this kind of a limud. Now many times certain changes appeal to us, and we'd say, well, given today different situation, different realities, different set of circumstances, perhaps under these circumstances we ought to change this or that. Well, sometimes that's true. But you better be very, very, very certain that in fact the change is called for, and that it's not going to do more harm than good, that you're not going to dig a hole into which you're going to fall. So in our own lifetime, or not exactly in our lifetime, but let's say within the lifetime at least of your parents, perhaps your grandparents, my parents, Klal Yisrael underwent a historically monumental change, which worked out very well, Baruch Hashem. At least many people in Klal Yisrael think that way. But on the other hand, there were also, I'm sure, changes which ended, which ended in absolute catastrophe. What's the change I'm thinking of which ended very well, and where a hole was dug in which either nobody fell? The area I'm thinking of is the area of girls' chinuch. Nowadays you have sisters, you have everybody goes to seminary, right? You get a girl goes to high school, and then after high school, so they're clever. Most girls do that. From the girls, go to seminary, this seminary, that seminary, go to seminary. Well, there's an assumption that there's a degree of education, Jewishly speaking, which a girl ought to be exposed to. Now, that is a relatively new idea. Historically, this happened in the 20s. And it's really very interesting to know what a major change this was. There was somebody called Rav Moshe Auerbach. He was a very, very big Olam Gadol. He was a Mishunadika Mechanech. And in the teens of this century, he was in Eretz Yisrael, opening schools, former schools in the new Yishuv. He had been called the Franz Sonnenfeld, Dolly Soil, and Eretz Yisrael. He was from Germany. He came to Eretz Yisrael and started schools. There was the Chadorim were in Yerushalayim, so they were no problem. But in the new Yishuv, where there were lots of former Ikarim, former farmers and so on, there was a Shaila like the Chinuch, so there were lots of fry schools. So they brought him into Eretz Yisrael to open a network of former schools. Anyway, so then came the First World War. And as you know, Eretz Yisrael was occupied by the British. Lord Allenby came in, and so he was a German national, so he had to leave Eretz Yisrael. So at that time, the Gerer Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, which is not, of course, the Einziger Gerer Rebbe, not the one before him, but the one before that, called him to Poland. That was in the early 20s, and asked him to be the menahel of a Beis Yaakov, of a girls' school in Warsaw. So he writes in his autobiography, he writes what he found when he got there. And he says it was an absolutely impossible situation. He says, throughout you must remember, the Warsaw of the 20s, that was when Chassidus was betokfai, right? Gerer Rebbe then in Poland must have had numbers, probably close to 50,000, maybe more Chassidim. I mean, like those, I really can't say the numbers exactly, I don't know. But it was overwhelming. And he was only one. Right? The whole Chassidus of fallen Galitzi. So he says it was a milsa of the Shriach Ma'od. It was very, very Shriach to have people, you know, on Shabbos sitting at home, that the fathers were sitting and learning with their sons in the living room. And next door, the girls were sitting writing term papers for university. What was happening? What was happening was that they didn't know how to be mechanech their daughters. I mean, for centuries, the meduba was that the boys were learned with and the girls simply weren't learned with. They went to the kitchen and they stood with their mothers and they learned how to make challahs and then they learned how to make challahs and that was perfectly okay. And that way they were mechanech doiras and doiras and doiras of Yiddish chapter in the best and shenst possible way. When the changes came, when emancipation came about, when people started changing and society started changing, they weren't equipped to handle it. No, they weren't quick enough off their feet to realize that a change was needed and that something had to be done about it. So they kept on being mechanech the girls in the same old way, and the girls didn't take it. And they went off to university. And in Mela, they associated Judaism with Cholent, and sometimes the Cholent gets burned, they weren't interested. So they threw it up. So the Ger Rebbe called this man to Poland to begin a structured and considered chinuch for girls. And that together with Sarah Schneider, Papillier Deutschlander, and the people who were involved in this, created Beis Yaakov, which today, of course, is taken for granted. Now, today it isn't a chiddush to us, but you can imagine that in those days, the fact that the Ger Rebbe, who was, of course, the most influential Rebbe in Poland, was masking to that, was an absolute, like, you can't even imagine what that means, right? Because it went diametrically against the Hanhogas of centuries. So he was a clear-sighted man, Chacham is Odev Minavi, who was able to see that the time had come not only to tolerate but to encourage a change, and he had the guts to do it, and he saved all our mothers and created the society which we have today, Baruch Hashem. I'm sure there are people who consider it a regression, not a progression. Some see the Shavuot, it's still not Mekubel. But the broad mainstream of former Judaism today is Goyreset, and it's Goyreset not only as a B'di'evet, but as a Lechat Chela. But that took a lot of guts to make that change. Very interesting, he writes that they had a problem in the school when he came, and that was that the language of instruction for the secular subject was Polish, but for the Jewish subject was Yiddish. And therefore the girls who came to the school weren't interested in the Hebrew subjects because they looked down on Yiddish. Yiddish was a sort of a jargon, it wasn't a respectable language, didn't really have much of a grammar. And it, you know, it's a mixture of dozens of different languages. It's not a chosh of a language, at least not in a secular sense. So the question was whether the chinuch could be improved by changing the language of instruction from Yiddish to Hebrew. But that was also a major, major decision. And funnily enough, all the parents were against it. Like, how can you do that? See how interesting it is. Here they had their daughters for Mechalel Shabbos, and they were trying to send them to the school to try and salvage a little bit of Yiddishkeit, but they weren't prepared to make the switch from Yiddish to Hebrew, until he went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe was masking, and then that started. I mean, we have a very, very interesting example of a change well taken, and Baruch Hashem very much there. The other side of that coin is, what is it, 60 or 50% intermarriage rate in America today, based on the very minor changes which the reform movement undertook at the beginning when it began. What were the issues at the beginning of reform? Very minor ones. Right? Cut out a yoke, face, your compurka, face, and what were the other issues? Like the chasmas in the shul instead of outside the shul. Very, very minor issues, very minor changes. And the people who made the changes for reasons which were good and valid in their eyes, they did not have that wisdom to see the Neulad. Didn't see that the Ezer Chacham Haraya as a Neulad. They didn't realize that as they began chipping away at things, changing from the sermon instead of from Yiddish to German or to Hungarian or whatever it was, in whichever place it was, that gradually this would eat away at the fabric of the Messiah, and you landed up in the way that we know today. Chayfa Gumatz by Yipayt. If the early reformers would see what happened today, 100 years later, they would turn in their graves, assuming that they're in their graves, were cremated probably. But you know, that was certainly wasn't what they had in mind. Why am I thinking about it? Because I been thinking about this story a lot, and it's been on my mind, and I'm not sure how to think about it. I'll tell you the story, and you'll tell me what the right way is of thinking about it. First, I'll tell you the background, what made me start thinking. I came across a story, a very interesting story. Maybe I mentioned it to some of you, I didn't remember. But that there was a story in Russia, under the Tsars, when they wanted to eliminate the Chadorim in Russia. They wanted to establish schools instead, you know, secular, like the kind of schools which we have today, learning secular, also with Limud Ekadesh, but introduce a secular educational system. And all the Rabbonim and the Rosh Yeshivas were, of course, adamantly opposed to that. So there was a meeting in Peterburg. Did we mention this last week? Does it sound familiar? So there was a meeting of all the Rosh Yeshivas and Rabbonim in Peterburg, which is Leningrad today. There was the capital, the Yehavira, and they had a meeting to see what they could do about it. So one of the suggestions was that it would be a good idea to have somebody in Peterburg, a lobby, to look after the interests of the Chador. In other words, he should be there, he should know what legislation is being proposed, he should know who's doing the proposing, he should be able to lobby the people. Somebody there to represent the interests of the Chadorim community. So the issue came up, who should do that? Who should be the person to take care of that? So all the Rabbonim agreed on a man who was a very close associate of Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, father of Rav Chaim. And he was a very familiar and efficient person, somebody who knew the ropes. And everybody felt that he was a very, very good man for this job. So they voted to have him be the ombudsman, the lobbyist for the Chadorim in Peterburg. So Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik got up and says he protests. He's going to veto. Co-worker. So if anybody should agree to have him do it, it should be he. Like, why does he object? So he said that he objects on the basis of a gemara. As a gemara, it said like this, that as a maaser, that somebody gave a dinner zahav to an isha to watch. But instead of telling her it was a dinner zahav, he only told her it was a dinner kesef. Well, she thought she was watching a dinner kesef, whereas in fact it was a dinner zahav. So then later on she was paisheya. So the halacha was that she only has to pay for her dinner kesef, not for her dinner zahav. Because she can tie them. The tirusa, the kasper, kablis alai. The tirusa, the dava, like kablis alai. I was only mekabel on myself a dinner kesef, not a dinner zahav. The additional shmira of a dinner zahav, I wasn't mekabel on myself. She wasn't her share. So Rav Yashiv Vertainet like this. So Zetadach, he says that you can watch a dinner Zohar more than you watch a dinner Kesef. He says, I regard the Chadorim, the existence and the continuation of the Chadorim, I regard it as a dinner Zohar. I see that the future of Klal Yisrael depends on these Chadorim. I cannot envision a Klal Yisrael without the Chadorim. My friend, my associate, I know him. He's an Elul Chayit, he's a fine person, he's a good person, he's a well-meaning person, he's a religious person, he's an efficient person, us, right? But by him, the Chadorim are Dinei Kesef. If the chips are down and you were to ask him, can there be a Klal Yisrael without the Chadorim, he could say, well, yeah, you know, like we can do it another way too, there are other ways of doing things. So Yashiv said, I'm not willing to have a shomer on my dinner zohar who thinks that it's a dinner kesef. With the best intentions in the world, he's machshev it, he'll watch it carefully, he'll do his job in a thoughtful and conscientious way, but he's not going to do it at the dinner zohar level, and therefore he's the wrong man for the job. I came across this maaser, and since then I haven't slept very well. Not quite true, I've slept very well, Baruch Hashem, but let's put it this way, since then I shouldn't have slept very well, because it created in me a constant ambivalence about many of the ideas which I have. You know, people always have to make decisions. You have this against that. Now, which wins? I'll tell you a little story. Just as an issue which came up, and sort of while I was thinking about that, I was thinking about that. But a couple of years ago, I was in New York, so a friend of mine, a Rosh Yeshiva, asked me what I held about the following case. Interesting case. And I told him what I held, and I argued cogently, I think, for my opinion. But now I'm wondering whether it wasn't a question of a dinner zohar, dinner kesef issue. Interesting story. It was he runs a yeshiva in New York, and they had a good yingle, a yingle, 16, 17 year old boy, beautiful, learning well, everything was nice, he's a nice kid. The problem was that Nevuchi was a yosem, he didn't have a father, his father died, and he lived with his mother. And for his mother, he was it, she had nothing else in the world except this boy, and she loved him very much, and was very possessive about him. And she didn't want him to live in the dormitory in the yeshiva, she wanted him home. Otherwise she would have been completely alone. No, the trouble was that in the home there's televisions all over the place. So the kids, a 16, 17 year old kid, what should he do? I mean, so such a tzaddik is not. So at night, instead of learning, which he would have done if he would have been living in yeshiva, he'd watch television. I don't know whether he watched television the whole night, but it was a stir in his aliyah. So the shaila was, should moral pressure be applied to pry this kid loose and get him to yeshiva? It wasn't a question of his not learning. During the day he learned, she sent him to yeshiva, everything was fine. But at night, it could have made a major difference to him whether he would be at home and have this constant Yetzer Hara sitting on his back, whether he should watch this or that show or shouldn't, or whether he should be in yeshiva. No? Who wants to pass on? What? I don't think so. No, I mean, that's not how I remember the shaila. But the question, everything would have been all right, except that he would have been in yeshiva and learned well, and the mother would have been at home and been lonesome. What's the... Huh? What's the other thing? What?
I mean, if there's a shadow, the mother would take him out of the school, so what does the...
So Zitha, they should take him to yeshiva.
What does that Would feel lonely? I mean, there were not enough bachelor to get close to him.
No. The question was the mother. The mother is alone at home, and this is her only child. No? What's that?
It seems as though the Kesavish pressured it the same way. But I'm very much opposed to breaking up the social structure of the family. Cause antagonism between the mother and the son. You know, you don't want to come home, and he views the mother as an enemy, and and therefore I can't come home, and you're in my way, and it. I mean, of course it's going to be terrible. It's going to be at home. It's going to be watching TV. I assume that TV 10 years ago.
This was 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So
this was the Sheriff of Abiyam.
Yeah. 2 years ago, I don't know, but certainly if it was 10 years ago, I would say let him stay home. Let him come home with the awareness. I mean, if he'll probably, you know, Schlatz to the yeshiva one tonight, so he somehow put that.
Are you guys going to remain friends? Like, Shlomo says he doesn't even see another son.
I can't sanction battles between children.
Good for you, at least you're saying that shit. Good. Was that good? Yeah. What would you say if you're. No, you got to make a decision.
I think the major problem is not just the mother with the child, but the television. In the first line of battle, you get the television.
And do what? So what would you guide that Rosh Hashiva to do? Yeah, good. I mean, by the time of the givens were that the mother wasn't prepared to do that. I mean, that was a gift. You know, that was part of the givens.
I mean, I think that the child development would be more important than
not killing. So you would have hijacked the kid and got into yeshiva. Right, anybody? Anybody hold like Beryl, or is he going to be a lonesome Koyle Bamidbar? No, anybody got any opinions? Come on, don't tell me you don't have opinions. Everybody's got to have an opinion. What do you say? You mean gradually wean him away. Yeah, that's a good idea, I think. I'll tell you what I argued. I held strongly like Beryl. I said, my advice was not to. Now, not because I'm anti-learning. Some of my best friends learn. That wasn't my judgment. Not because I'm pro-television, but because, and not the pshat is because I weighed the needs of the child as against the needs of the mother and said the mother's needs are preemptive. I didn't mean that. But I felt that by taking the kid to yeshiva, you're ruining the kid. That's what I thought. Why did I feel you're ruining the kid? Because you're being mechanechem that it's okay to be frum on somebody else's places. Right? In other words, you're telling the child, yeah? Steel your heart, harden your heart against your mother's needs. Your mother's crying, your mother's lonesome, right? But don't care about that, or do care about that. Pay lip service to it, but you've got to learn. Right? So I felt that by doing that, you'd be teaching the child a distorted kind of Judaism. You don't step on somebody's neck on your way up to Olam Haba. Right? In other words, to give yourself a lift up to Olam Haba. That was my thinking. I said, you don't want to have the kid watch television. Yeah? So start a campaign, offer him $25 a week, give him a prize, yeah? It's no answers, right? But, I mean, not because I was weighing the mother's needs against the child's needs. I was felt that it was a wrong chinuch for the child. That's what I held. I have to tell you, nobody was that was by my daughter's sheva brachas, this might have happened. So I came in from Baltimore, so my friend was one of the guests at the sheva brachas, so before we sat down to the meal, we were schmoozing, so he told me that he asked me this shayla. He didn't ask me as a shayla. I mean, he didn't have to ask me any shaylas, but the shayla came up. So when I spoke at the Sheva Brachas, I used that as my topic and presented my ideas on the subject. So everybody was completely opposed to me, of course, and everybody thought that I was talking through my head. Now, that's the way I held. I'm glad at least, I think it's my first comfort that somebody holds like me. But after I saw this story with the Dinner Zov and Dinner Kesev, I began to question myself that maybe my willingness to have the kids stay home was because perhaps the learning aspect of learning, let's say, in a television-less environment, just is maybe only a dinner kesef for me. In other words, it could be that if the mile of learning in yeshiva of the situation which obtained at the time is at the dinner zohar level, perhaps you've got to take such a step. You see, in other words, like it sort of makes me unsure of the value system. In other words, you tend to make decisions like that based on a certain value system, and not completely certain whether my value system, let's say, in over here where you have an issue of in order lechaveira and Torah learning sort of clashing a little bit, like which one takes precedence or which one sort of ought to be sort of unconditionally pursued is really a sort of a value decision, a dinner zohar, dinner kesef decision, and has to sort of be chashed oneself that one's value system may be a little screwed. The story I was going to tell you was where again, like my gut reaction was very much in one direction, but then when I remembered this story, I began to question myself. It was a story which Michal came home with just now from Eretz Yisrael. Told the Meister like this. Those of you maybe, some of you have been in Eretz Yisrael, and if you have probably, anyway, so in Eretz Yisrael there's a certain bria called a sheirut. Everybody been in Eretz Yisrael? Okay, so a sheirut is, for the benefit of the uninitiated, is a communal taxi, which there's a certain place where you have the sheirutz, and you go there, and as soon as you have five people, or six people, however many it is, to fill up the taxi to a certain destination, so the taxi leaves. So there's a sheirut between Yerushalayim and Bnei Brak, between Yerushalayim and Be'er-Sheva, whatever it is. That's a sheirut. So what can be simpler and nicer than a sheirut? The answer is nothing, except that there's a seating problem, which has to do with men and ladies sitting next to each other. So, generally speaking, if there's some men and some ladies, so you organize yourself in such a way that the men sit separately in the seat in the back, but the ladies, yeah, it's possible with a certain amount of computer skills to work these things out. So anyway, so Meister Shahoy, so Kachoy, so that Michal was going to Eivarak, let's say, and he was in a Sheirut, and there was a very, very frail old lady who had gotten in the back seat of the Sheirut, all ready to go to Bnei Brak. And two young fellows came along from people whose sort of religious sensibilities forbade them to sit next to this lady. And so now the issue was what to do. So they insisted that she should move to the front and change places with the man who was sitting there. So she said she can't because she's very old and frail and she's afraid to sit next to the door. She's scared. It sort of doesn't have a sense of security. When there's a door, they might open. All the people are afraid, and it's difficult. So, but these people insisted that they can't sit next to her. So the driver said, look, you have to get out. He told her, either you have to get out, or you have to change seats, or you have to pay double. If you pay double, then we can keep one seat empty next to you. And so one of the guys can sit at the back, And there'll be a space in between you, and the other guy will wait for the next shiva. So in the end, the story was that she was crying and this, and she went out. She left the taxi, didn't want to pay double, or couldn't afford to pay double, I don't know. Right? And went to the next shiva. End of story. So now, what are the moral lessons to be drawn from this story, besides that people shouldn't go with sheirut, which I don't think is a legitimate conclusion. So what are the rights and wrongs of this story? So, what's that? What's that? Yeah, what is your reaction? What? Like, I gave Michal the works. I told him it was done. Now, why did you say that? Why didn't you go to the back the next day? He blamed himself. It just didn't occur to him. Like he was nervous. It was like a painful scene, and he didn't have the didn't have the presence of mind to do that. But what's the moral of the story? Wie darf man abteitschen in such a story? Good for the Jews, bad for the Jews. Did the Rabbanishim have Nachas Ruach, or didn't he have Nachas Ruach? Which is the basic criterion for our actions. Bell, what's that bell? Yeah?
I think that the two people in the back had a warp from Mishkal HaChassidus. As once you step out of the boundary of Halacha, you get into Chassidus already, then you're in a very precarious position when you discard other people's feelings. Now, if there had been a young girl in the back, and we're talking about something, it's a totally different story, it would be very dangerous for the two men. If you're dealing with an elderly woman, I don't think that they were within their rights by any stretch of the imagination to insist that she get up front. I mean, if she wanted to, fine, but if she didn't, and to make such a scene out of it, then either they should have just decided we're not taking this cab, or you know, under any circumstances, well, I don't know, that would have hurt the lady to a certain extent. Let them get in and keep their mouth shut, and that's it. In other words, there's a time to look away from, I hate to use the word, but I think that they were for mocking in that particular sense. The moral of the situation.
As long as you use that word and not another word, which I won't even pass across my lips,
The point is that when you're dealing with Chassidus,
yeah,
you have to take other people's feelings very much into consideration, and other people's feelings, I think, have a much higher regard are much higher regarded by the Reb Shalom than your chumras. The chumras also that they're cool. I think they were very wrong.
Shlomo?
Oh, wow. Well, when the son said he's obviously been brought up in a house where it was taboo, and you can think of, you know, 14 or 45. So why didn't they leave? Why was she 14?
Yeah.
It seems like if it was their taboo, they should have left.
No. Anybody pro what? Hey, what?
Well, I wouldn't tell him to leave either, because then the cab driver turns around to the lady and gives it to her. You know, I would just tell him to get in or get somebody else to take the
cab.
No, was that good? What's that?
I think they should pay double for her.
They should pay double for her. All right. So the side like this. My reaction, of course, was. Better than me, you know. but my reaction was very much so, and then I stopped myself and I wondered whether I was right, and the thing that stopped me was this: what we're talking about, the dinner Zohar Kesef deal. I mean that these two young people, Lechayra, yeah, were absolutely impossible. I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, they could have gone, let them walk, yeah, or let them go to the next shevet. I mean, they were probably not acting very nicely. I mean, I must assume that without knowing, perhaps there were extenuating circumstances. But just the story as the story, it sounds pretty awful. But if we ask ourselves, why did they act this way? I mean, let's postulate that they were decent people. I'm sure that, I mean, they were obviously before me. Yeah, they'd obviously been brought up in it from a home, and presumably were interested in pleasing the Rabbanish letter. So what created the background against which they would have acted in such a nasty way?
It was habit.
In other words, that there's a certain avira, right? There's a certain cultural mix, right, which makes this issue of sitting next to a woman so significant that perhaps their sense of values between Ben Oren Lamok and Ben Oren Chaver got skewered somehow, right? It didn't occur to them that the decent and gentlemanly thing to do would have been to wait for another shirut if somehow their religious sensibilities were offended. Perhaps she was a friar lady, it could be, right? And Bechlal, that this avira of confrontation between Frumi Yidden and Frei Yidden contributed, I don't know. So I think, of course, that the story Kishehila Atzmo is a horrible story. But if I had to make a decision of tampering with the cultural mix which produced this story, I would be hesitant. In other words, perhaps the Erech of Tznius is sufficiently important, is a dinner zohar, for often that perhaps it's better to have such a cultural avira, even if such excesses, which are obviously misguided, take place within it. Maybe Klal Yisrael ought to be willing to live with those kind of horrors rather than compromise on a madrege sneers, which may be a dinosaur level. I have no suffix that if I would have been there, if I would have been in Michal's place, I would have gone to the bag and I would have solved the problem. Yeah? Michal has heard from me that if ever such a thing would happen again, of course he would go and sit in the bag. Whether that is right or wrong, I am not willing to say. I'm not so sure that it's right. Right? I don't know whether I would have a common language with them, but if they were interested in my opinion, I would tell them that I thought that they had erred, and that the right thing would have been to wait for another shiva. Right? To take an old lady like Nicole described. I mean, of course, she has in the description. Like, I think between Nicole's telling and my telling, we've probably added a few years to her age and her frailty, right? But you know, given the assumption that she was like an old lady and scared and afraid and nervous, obviously it was inexcusable. I mean, there's
you're not tampering with Nicole's music out there, so to speak, with his at all when you tell him to sit in the back. If you tell them to sit in the back, you're tampering with their upbringing.
Yeah, but maybe, if Michal had gone, right, to the back, maybe they would have thrown a stone at him. And perhaps they would have been right. Yeah? And I was going, if they would have seen that, yeah, as a piercer, that they say, Yerushalayim fit mezich azoy, you understand? Maybe they're right. You follow what I mean? In other words, I don't know whether the lemaisa of what they did was right. Yeah? But that the value which they were defending may be worth defending, and that maybe if I or Michal as my shliach or somebody who would be like-minded would come along and say, baloney, I'm going to do what I think is right, yeah? Maybe that's not right. Right? Maybe Chofer Guma, yeah? Bor Yipol. Who knows whether a compromise in the Madregas of Tznius, let's say, which I considered appropriate in Yerushalayim today, yeah? Won't be Neusiperus, Deiris down the line, that Cholila, the Madrega of Tznius and Klal Yisrael is worse than it should be. That's exactly what I mean. In other words, like, it's important not to jump to gut reactions in these things and to weigh them very carefully. And I'm not so sure where the weight would be.
In a situation like this, where a decision had to be made before you declare your side, what's going to happen 20 generations from now? I mean, that's what I've been talking about, you know, what's going to happen later on.
Yeah. No, so I'm saying like this, I have no suffix that these people were wrong. Whether I would have been right in sitting down there, I'm not so sure. I would have done it and I will do it in Mitzvah if the situation were to arise. But I'm not quite sure that it's the right thing. And when I say I will do it, I don't mean that's so bedavka either. I mean, I would be open for somebody to come along and tell me Hatzachan is not for that. Right? Maybe what I should do under the same circumstances is not to sit down there, right? But to pay the cab driver for two empty seats. Maybe that's what you should do. Right? I mean, it's not so personal.